Thank you, everybody, for coming along today. The aim of the session today is to discuss the role of the actuary in the post-LAGIC world, which, as we know, is sort of we've got to start anticipating now. So we've structured the session today as a debate, setting out two alternative interpretations of what the world could look like. We've deliberately polarized these alternatives to encourage discussion. So no personal views, well, maybe there are some personal views in there, but it's to give you a feel of the two possible dichotomies there. So on the one hand, we have the role of the actuary has been marginalized, and on this side, we'll be talking to that. And on the other hand, there's a huge opportunity for actuaries on this side as it looks into the requirements for actuarial advice on managing the business of a life company. So it's all about the advice, and it's still supporting that, and that's sort of it has been actually included in the response paper. So today we're looking to get your views on what the profession and the institute needs to do to meet the challenges and opportunities, and how to make sure it is an opportunity. So the current thoughts, and these are just things to start your thinking, you know, whether there should be ongoing interaction with APRA, responses to further guidance that APRA has promised, like guidance on ICAPs, development of guidance, is that needed from the Institute, for example, on areas like risk margins, target surplus policy, and other sort of connected sort of guidance that we already have, information notes. Should we be raising the awareness of the profession as to the opportunities? Should we as a profession be stepping up to that? And should we raise our standards as actuaries? Are we actually providing the right level of advice? So those are just some of the thoughts that I'd like you to have in the back of your minds when you comment on this. This session will be recorded, so when you have any questions, somebody will bring around the microphones. And it's also dialed in from various areas, I assume Melbourne and is the key one. But first, before we get going, let me just introduce you to the two teams. They've all got a deep involvement in the LAGIC changes, and are either members of the task force of the LIWMPC, closely linked to it. So we first of all have Heather, who's the capital management actuary at CBA, currently running the implementation of the LAGIC capital changes at CBA. Then we have Ian Bull-Craig, head of actuarial reporting at TAL and looking after the LAGIC program there. We have on the other side, we have Brendan Council from EY, who's supporting a number of clients with their LAGIC implementations, and then Kevin, who we all know is the appointed actuary of MRC. So on that point, I'm just checking that you on the phone, people on the phones can hear. Excellent. In which case, I'll now hand over to Heather and Ian to make the first points.
Good afternoon. Heather and I have been given the opportunity to put forward a view that the role of the appointed actuary under the proposed capital standards is at risk. Neither Heather nor I are currently appointed actuaries. And it may be after this discussion that we never be offered this role. or at least we may put forward such a convincing argument that we convince ourselves never to apply for the role. But in the spirit of Turkey's voting for Christmas, we feel there's certainly a case worth arguing that the Actuaries Institute needs to support both the appointed actuary and other valuation actuaries through this time of change. And my experience is that actuaries generally look forward to change, so the arguments Heather and I are making are not designed to be against change. More, we feel there's four key points we need to consider by institute members under the change in capital framework. Firstly, the new standards leave much less room for the appointed actuary to use his or her years of experience in determining suitable provision for risk. Secondly, the change, along with the complexity of the new regulations, will direct the appointed actuary role to become more technical and less business-focused. Thirdly, with the board making decisions and APRA applying supervisory adjustments on top of that, the appointed actuary will be less influential in managing the capital of the business. And finally, the combination of all these three make it far less attractive for young, talented professionals to aim to be appointed actuaries. Covering off the first of these points, under the current regulations, there are a number of ways that the appointed actuary can apply judgment in setting the appropriate levels of reserves for the risks within their business. Appointed actuaries by nature have many, many years of experience, and they can draw on this when setting margins of risk within the ranges on LPS 3.04. My experience with this is that it allows appointed actuaries to allow for a range of developments within their insurance organisation. For example, they have the scope to adjust margins on insurance and longevity risk as the business grows, as data becomes credible, as experience is developed. Similarly, they have scope to change or review margins on investment-linked business and on expenses based on trends in terms of how well the company is managing operational risk or worsening trends in experience. Current wording in LPS 3.04 actually states that reliance is placed on the professionalism of the actuary for appropriate assessment of the capital required, which I think is quite a strong statement from APRA in the current regulations. This obviously doesn't exist in the new regulations. Having this scope for judgment can reward insurers where experience is well monitored, where risks are diversified, and where operational risk is reducing. But more importantly, it can let the appointed actuary add additional margins based on their perception of developing risks. The new standards remove the scope for the appointed actuary to have the same level of prudency within the prescribed capital amount. You might argue that target surplus still exists, and that this is the means by which appointed actuaries can use their experience to set their own internal margins. However, as we'll touch on later, the impact of the supervisory adjustment and the way that APRA is using their powers to change the amount of capital that's required to be held may well mean that the target surplus and this ability within target surplus is not as good. I was trying to think of similar experiences elsewhere in professional qualified individuals who use their years of experience in judgment. And the best example I came up with last night was I was thinking about judges. Judicial system, when deciding criminal sentencing, they're permitted to use judgment, often with a mandatory minimum, but they can base on their perception around the nature of the offence, impact on the victim, the circumstances under which crime takes place, and they can adjust the sentencing appropriately. We feel that the Institute should be asking APRA why they are not using more of the years of appointed actuary experience to help set the appropriate levels of capital. These are for organisations that often the appointed actuary will know better than anyone else. Why is it for judges you have discretion, but for us, not so discretion? Now I'll pass over to Heather for the second section of our debate.
Hi, guys. I'm going to kick off with a really bad actuarial joke, and the reason I'm telling you it's a joke is so that you'll know when to laugh, because it's really not that funny. So two people are flying in a hot air balloon, and they realise that they're lost. They see a man on the ground, so they navigate to where they'll be able to talk to him, and they yell down to the guy, can you help us? We don't know where we are. The man on the ground replies, you're in a hot air balloon? About 200 feet above the ground. One of the men in the balloon replies, you must be an actuary. And the guy on the ground said, yes, how did you know? He said, well, you gave us information that is accurate and completely useless. So it may be an old joke and not particularly funny, but I do wonder how many times our colleagues have thought exactly that. We've tried very, very hard in recent years to shed the traditional stereotype of the actuary, the one who was lacking in sufficient personality to be an accountant, the one who could be likened to a computer with a heartbeat. But I think that there's a very real concern that the complex nature of the new standards will make it even harder for the actuary to come across as business savvy and make it harder for us to shed those stereotypes. I sort of fear that under the new standards, us actuaries will have to develop a new catchphrase, which will be something along the lines of, well, that depends. So I'm going to ask Ian to pose as the business and, you know, ask me as an actuary some pretty straightforward questions.
Yes, Heather, what will be the impact on capital if we increase our equity holdings?
Well, that depends. What other asset classes are you holding? How stable is your asset mix? Which statutory fund will you be putting those assets into? Does that statutory fund have insurance risk in it?
I'd like to write 5 new large group schemes over the next year. How much capital will I need?
Well, that depends. How much retail business are you planning to write? Are you expecting any large group schemes to come off your books? Which statutory fund are you planning to write those in? What other products are in that fund? And will these new schemes materially change the mix of your business?
That's not very helpful. Finally, you must be able to help with this one. I'm doing a cost-benefit analysis for a big project that will significantly reduce the business operational risk. How much will this reduce capital by?
It won't. And what do you think the business will think of us when we can't give a simple answer in a timely manner to seemingly very straightforward questions? Do you think that they will understand the complexity of the new standards, realise the interdependencies and inflection points that we're having to consider, and appreciate the impact of the statutory fund structure on our capital? Or do you think that they will roll their eyes and think, typical bloody actuaries, and stop seeking our advice? So I'd now like to pass back over to Ian to expand on how actuaries may become less influential within the business.
Our third concern is that the business influence will reduce. Currently in life insurance companies, appointed actuaries, usually accompanied by an actuarial capital team, tend to educate, influence, and responsible for ensuring the capital regulations are adhered to, but also capital management, painting scenarios around how capital will change over time, recommendations of dividend payment and stress scenarios. Under APRA's proposals, the board now has the responsibility of capital. And it may seem like a sensible extension of board policy, a board existing rules and regulations to include this, but it does potentially bring into conflict the role between the appointed actuary and that of the board. Imagine a scenario where the appointed actuary is drafting the FCR and feels the board has taken a stance on capital position which the appointed actuary does not feel is prudent. There could be some people argue that the actuary is becoming APRA's inside person, and even though this is not the case, there is a risk that the perception will exist within the company. What does this do to the business relationship with the appointed actuary and with the actuarial team? It may be extreme, it may be an obvious argument is in the new regime the appointed actuary will still be the expert that the board listens to on capital, and that the appointed actuary role still has valid. However, with the supervisory adjustment, I don't think it's hard to imagine a scenario whereby APRA intervention, either through restricting dividends or applying a supervisory adjustment, could reflect on the reputation of the appointed actuary, particularly if they've given advice to the board, which is contrary to, I guess, the understanding and recommendation of APRA. If a company's strategy on new business, on reinsurance, on investment management has to be altered as a result of a supervisory adjustment by APRA, then I think the fickle finger of blame may well be pointed towards the appointed actuary. The board has the responsibility, but is the actuary now in a more of a crossfire position? It may be that the means that the actuary can regain the influence or can maintain the influence in the business is to move more into risk management or chief risk officer, which is perhaps a natural progression of our skills. However, if the Institute wants to maintain the appointed actuary role as a prestigious one, it may need to think about how the appointed actuary interaction with the board will change under the new regime. Change not just from a regulatory responsibilities point of view, but also subtly within organisations as pressure builds to provide good quality value-adding capital advice.
So the danger of all of this, and something that should be of concern to all of us as members of the Institute, is that the role of the appointed actuary, or the traditional actuary, is becoming increasingly less attractive. We're already struggling to attract graduates with a broad skill set which extends beyond being good at statistics and being able to write a macro for absolutely anything. If we want to, you know, appeal as a profession to graduates with strong commercial acumen and great communication skills, then we have to be able to offer them jobs which use and in fact demand those very skills. However, as more and more of the actuary's time is taken up with documentation and producing detailed evidence of how they're monitoring the ICAP and how they're interacting with other processes, there's less time available for the real value-adding tasks. And if, as Ian argued, there's less scope for judgment within the standards, does this mean that companies will begin to look for people with a different skill set to perform these duties? Somebody who has technical skills, able to apply a formula, without necessarily requiring business acumen or a strong risk background. Now, like I said, already the role of the actuary, I believe, is becoming less and less attractive to aspiring actuaries, or the role of the appointed actuary, who are finding greater challenge and use of their skill set in the less traditional fields. So going forward, will we be finding roles on the board or in risk or in other places necessary in order to really add value? And might we begin to forego the qualification altogether? I mean, if we're going for one of these less traditional roles, is it going to be detrimental to have the word actuary on your CV with the preconceptions and stereotypes that that might invite in that different environment where, you know, we are seen as the calculator with a heart? So before passing on to Kevin and Brendan, I want to leave you with a somewhat flippant question. If somebody offered you a role where you get to apply a formula to a bunch of numbers, you get to give advice to the board that will ultimately be superseded by APRA, and you get to confuse the business at every turn, would you take it?
We should say they've just painted a very bleak picture, which we do not intend to rebut. We would just like to paint a different world and a different outcome that we see. But we should, before we start on that, we should just talk about what we mean by the role of the appointed actuary. I'm of the view the appointed actuary is clearly the face of the actuarial advice of the organisation. So when we're talking about the appointed actuary, we're talking about all the actuaries in the organisation who are providing advice in whatever form that happens in the organisation. Because there is clearly a lot of areas of advice that actuaries currently give advice on. And to me, this change in regime that we're going through is clearly and unambiguously a huge opportunity for the appointed actuary and all the actuaries in the financial management of the company. Now, if we just start back from what we do now, and you can actually see how you can actually leverage from this, the actuary provides advice in at least three distinct areas that I can think of. One is product terms and conditions. Under LPS 320, we're required to give advice on those terms and conditions. And in giving that advice, the actuary clearly focuses on the nature and understanding of risks, the pricing of risks, the risk mitigation strategies, and the capital management required to support those plans. Another area of advice, and this one is not statutorily required, and that is on investment strategies. The appointed actuary's advice is often sought on the suitability and implications of alternative investment strategies, particularly for businesses that involve capital guarantees or any other sort of guarantees. And again, in giving that advice, what does the actuary focus on? It's on asset liability risks, asymmetric risks, and capital management. And finally, a piece of advice that has been there for decades, if not centuries, is capital management. The actuaries have been involved in advising the companies on capital management issues, and in doing so addresses risk mitigation, risk management strategies, and target surplus policies, which are important. Currently, the actuary now has to also review and comment on and give his opinion on the effectiveness of risk management strategies. All up, that current area of advice is pretty holistic, focusing on risk and risk management. Now, under the new regime, the company actually is required to get this advice if it's actually going to manage the business. And the actuary's advice will be an important cog in embedding the robust and safe, sustainable risk management and capital management process in the company. You look the areas that will, the areas of advice that will be demanded upon. There will be scenario analyses, financial risk assessments, risk management strategies, traditional projected cash flows and profits and capital. Then there's what is the suitable ongoing monitoring process of both the effectiveness of the risk management strategies and the effectiveness of the of your measuring devices. So I just see this as an enormous opportunity. There's one specific opportunity that we should not underestimate, and that is the introduction of ICAP. Everyone's aware, ICAP stands for Internal Capital Adequacy Assessment Process. Now, to me, the ICAP is a it pulls together the process where the company identifies its risk, understands its risk appetite, understands how it's going to approach and manage those risks, how it's going to mitigate those risks, and actually puts throughout the organisation a formal process where it can see what it's actually doing to run the business. That process should also talk about how these risks manifest themselves, and what are the strategies to respond to those risks as they emerge. And again, you put who is best placed in the organisation to actually understand that, and that is the appointed actuary or the actuarial team. And you start saying, well, how's that click? Why is that? And it's my view is that the actuary has the ability to join the nine dots, and there are nine dots here, because I worked it out how to be there. And I think not only is the actuary well positioned, he's probably uniquely positioned to join the nine dots. And I'll go through the nine dots. Understanding liability risks, understanding asset risks, understanding the interaction of assets and liability risks, what pricing for risk is taking place, what's the effectiveness of the risk management strategies, what are the capital implications of all of the above, what's the ongoing monitoring process and how successful that will be and efficient and sustainable that will be, understanding what processes are available and appropriate given a change of environment, and believe it or not, the communications necessary to explain to the decision makers what this all means to them. They're my nine dots. As I said, I think the actuary is uniquely placed to join the nine dots in the organisation. So hence, from far from marginalising the appointed actuary, I believe the new regime provides a great opportunity to leverage his or her talent in advising the company on risks, risk management and capital. Things we have been doing for at least a century, if not longer, in some organisations. Now let's address the issue about the supervisory adjustment. Clearly a company will wish to control its own fate and will not want to leave it up to APRA to determine how much capital it will need. So what is the key to that? I believe the key to that is the appointed actuary's advice in developing, recommending and maintaining a sound and responsive target surplus policy as the primary tool to assist the management. Once you have that on top of the prescriptive overlay of capital, I believe you are in a very good, strong position to identify what are the risks unique to this organisation, what are the deficiencies that the current standards may well have. The company actually then knows that, embraces that, and then able to manage it. And if APRA comes on with and say, here's an overlay that you need to put on for those risks, that's not an issue because they've already acknowledged it and they actually have it in their own control. So instead of your bleak picture, I believe the new regime elevates what we now do to being even more important and is recognised as being a central part of the sustainable financial management of the company. The skills and the experience of the profession that we've accumulated over many years provides a great platform for us grasping this opportunity. And what we want to hear from you guys is how we actually do that.
Thanks, Kevin. Kevin noted that the appointed actuary is uniquely positioned to join the nine dots in developing and maintaining the ICAP. The appointed actuary is not the only actuary in the life company, and I would argue that Kevin's points can be extended to the entire actuarial team within the company. So for my 5 minutes, I'm just going to have a look at the actuarial skill set in a little bit more detail and how the skill set would apply under the new regime. So let's first consider some of the key typical actuarial skills for actuaries in life companies. Actuaries and life companies typically have a deep understanding of life insurance business. They are well versed in financial and statistical modelling. They provide business insight based on their technical knowledge and the understanding of the business. More generally, actuaries are good at measurement, monitoring and management of risks. And they are used to communicating complex concepts to stakeholders within the business. Let's have a look at each of these in turn. Deep understanding of life insurance business. Actuaries working in life insurance companies are often some of the most knowledgeable in the company in their understanding of the business and its key drivers. Actuaries working at the coalface, so to speak, will be well placed to advise management and the board on the drivers of capital under the new requirements and what it all means for the business. The ICAAP requires, and I quote, a strategy for ensuring adequate capital is maintained over time, including specific capital targets set out in the context of the regulated institution's risk profile and the board's risk appetite. Actuaries understand the business, key risks, the company risk appetite. They can and should be providing input here. Secondly, financial and statistical modelling. Actuaries will continue to be the providers of the base capital calculation, modelling and setting of insurance margins, etc. Some may say that the role of the AA is being downgraded and that we will become mere calculators under the new regime. To that I would say, firstly, let's not downplay the importance of the calculation itself and acknowledge that there are a few others as well placed for this task. Secondly, I believe it's the taking of it to the next step where actuaries can really add the value. Calculations are now arguably more complex than previously. Actuaries are well placed to deal with the additional complexity and distill it for the business. There's also an opportunity to extend the modelling to provide broader input into business strategies. For example, what actions can the company take to most efficiently transition under the new regime? How will these actions impact on the business strategy, product mix, company structure, etc.? And I know we said we wouldn't rebut, but I can't resist. So where the senior manager asked the actuary what's going to be the capital impact of writing whatever group risk scheme or whatever it was, and the actuary came back with half a dozen questions, I would say that instead of coming back with half a dozen questions, we're well placed to provide the answers to those questions and put forward a proposal on how that would impact the business strategy and be involved in the business strategy and setting that strategy. Thirdly, actuaries providing business insight. This skill really starts to bring together some of those previously discussed. So the calculations are important, but it's the insight that the actuary can provide that can really add value to the business. For example, what are the drivers of capital under the new regime and what impact do certain management actions have on the company's regulatory capital and target surplus? These insights will be the culmination of forward projections, stress testing, etc., all now required under the new regime as part of the ICAAP process and will be performed presumably by the actuarial team. While the board is now responsible for regulatory capital and the ICAAP is the actuary who is best placed to advise on this, unless the company board is comprised of actuaries, the board and senior management will be reliant on the actuary to advise not only on the capital numbers, but the business impact and the proposed responses. Measurement, monitoring and management of risk, actuaries understand and in particular are able to quantify the risks to which the company is exposed. So the ICAAP requires, and I quote, adequate systems, procedures to identify, measure, monitor and manage risks arising from the regulated institution's activities on a continuous basis to ensure that capital is maintained at a level consistent with the regulated institution's risk profile and the board's risk appetite. So as noted previously, few have the holistic understanding of the business, of the risks to the business to which the company exposed and are able to quantify and measure them. Again, actuaries appear to be better placed than most others to provide input to the ICAAP. Finally, communication of complex concepts to stakeholders. The board now has heightened responsibilities under the new regime. Further, expect senior management to take more of an interest, if they aren't already, in regulatory capital, especially given APRA's ability to apply adjustments to a company's capital requirements. It's now even more important that the actuarial function provides more than just a technical role and is able to adequately distill the complexity and explain in simple terms what it means for the business. The actuary has a key role to play here, and if we don't step into this role, then I believe the actuarial function will just become a technical function, and it will be providing information to others who will potentially take the credit. In conclusion, calculation of capital continues to be very important, and actuaries will continue to provide this role. However, the opportunity exists for the actuary to extend their role and distill the complex requirements and work through what it all means for the business. That's where we can really add value. If we pigeonhole ourselves, then the key role in communicating our insights to stakeholders is likely to be filled by others. Thank you.
Thank you. We've heard here two pictures of what the world could be like going forwards. I would say a bleak view on one side, and a greater opportunity, a ray of light, if you wish, on the other. When I go to clients, a message I often hear is that they want their actuaries to provide insight, to provide the value add. They don't want number crunchers. So the businesses are also crying out for this development as well. So I think what I'd like to hear today is how we can make sure that we grasp the opportunity and turn it into a positive, and rather than ending up with all the negatives and the downside. So today, I'd love to hear your views. That's the main point of today, is to hear your views, where you think we're going, what you think we as a profession and then as an institute can do to make sure we go on the positive path rather than the negative path. So at that point, the microphone's around, and I look forward to the first question. At that point, I will also ask if there's anybody on the phone that has any... Sorry.
Okay.
You go.
Greg Martin. Just a couple, I don't think it's a question. Maybe I'll make a statement and people can respond to it. I think one of the things we did wrong with Moz in some respects is we spent too much time trying to do the right calculation, and too many actuaries got stuck in the box doing calculations. We're the ones with the results, but not the ones giving information or, you know, analysing what it meant and therefore strategic ramifications. So I think one of the tricks we have to be very careful about some of this stuff is we don't try and over-engineer what we have to do, and we have to try and be clear as that we spend lots of time thinking about the ramifications of things that we do and communicate that part of it all. And that's when you become valuable. And Kevin's 9 points. I'm not quite sure whether your 9th point, Kevin, went to strategic ramifications of the outlook, but that maybe that's number 10 and rounds out the numbers. I was actually going to say, could you...
probably not.
whether you could actually write a letter to the editor of Actuary Australia or something and put your 9 points down, because they're pretty good points. But I think... that to my mind is really the main game, is, you know, not to get stuck and seen as the calculators, but being the people who interpret it. So I know there's some organisations that tend to separate out actuarial functions in the sense that there's a bunch of actuaries who work in finance are the ones who do the numbers, and they're the ones who get blamed for stuff, and the chief actuary or point actuary can be the one who sits back and does all the interpretive stuff. My little one is a plea to stop using the word target surplus. That's so 1980s. I think we got rid of second schedules back in 95 or 96. Something like economic capital or enterprise capital or reserves or something like that sounds far more sexy and modern to me.
Owen Wormald. It's interesting to hear the discussion about what the appointed actuary stands for. And it made me think about whose brand the appointed actuary really is. As a profession, we're actuaries. So is the appointed actuary a brand of the Actuaries Institute, or is it a brand of APRA, a designation that they insist gives a unique point of reference? And I thought back to when appointed actuary was introduced, and I think that at that time there was a much stronger and more constructive dialogue between the Institute and APRA, or its predecessor, ISC, and actuaries played a very significant role in the reworking of the Life Insurance Act to 1995. Now, 20 years later. Perhaps we're looking forward to the next iteration, but it just makes me wonder whether the brand of appointed actuary is one that APRA has now sort of taken command of, and therefore imposes more prescriptive technical requirements, and that the Institute really ought to be focused on what actuary is about rather than what appointed actuary is about. No, nothing that necessarily makes an appointed actuary the top of the pile of actuaries, the king of the actuaries. It was like that 10, 15, 20 years ago. It's not necessarily like that now. Actuarial brand is what we... I also did a little Google search just now on appointed actuary, and what came up, perhaps surprisingly, was a whole bunch of references to general insurance. We're here today talking about life insurance, but I think we're prompted by LAGIC, which is a Life in General initiative. It's interesting to see how appointed actuary has become a very strong brand, I would suggest, in our colleagues in the general insurance sector. So those few thoughts are probably thrown out onto the table as provocative, and see what people might respond to them.
Thank you, Owen. One point I would make is that we're talking about actuaries as a whole. I mean, Kevin made the point that it just is promulgated through the appointed actuary, and we see it as a whole. Yes, you're right, there is a special designation to the appointed actuary, but I disagree slightly that I think that it's been hijacked, but I can see where you're coming from. I'll leave others to respond as well. Bruce at the back.
Bruce Vincent. I just wanted to firstly pick up on Greg Martin's point. I agree that in the mid-90s, a lot of actuaries got buried in Moz, and I think we sort of missed the opportunity to be on the forefront and riding the wave in terms of the implications. So the question is, LAGIC a threat or opportunity for appointed actuaries and actuaries in general? I think it's an opportunity, and I think indeed, APRA sees it that way as well. Section 3.2 of the response to the submissions actually says that APRA expects a greater interaction between appointed actuaries and the board. And with the modifications of LPS 320, if it's anything like the process we go through for doing product advice, there's going to be a lot of interaction. But the key is obviously to make this valuable and relevant to the business. And so that's the key. On a point in terms of whether the Institute should... how should the Institute assist in this? I was mindful of LPS 220, another area of appointed actuaries and actuaries responsible, and you know, recent discussions of APRA. And I feel we need to be on the front foot in terms of the whole LAGIC issue and the Institute actively encouraging, as we're doing now, this sort of debate, and not wait for, you know, responses.
Ross Etherington. Two points. Firstly, on Greg's point about the complications with Moz years ago, I certainly agree, but just a point that perhaps arguably these new standards have added a bit more complication to the calculations, so that is perhaps another challenge for actuaries on explaining that to the wider business. And secondly, just a question for Kevin. Do you see... with the responsibilities going up to the board on capital management, do you see more actuaries perhaps being appointed to boards and perhaps a positive for the profession?
I don't think actuaries will be appointed to boards because of for LAGIC. I think they get pointed if they've got the right skill set and things like that, the board and things like that. So I would separate that issue.
So I agree. Skill set in the first place. Perhaps there's a bit more possibility there.
There may be. Yeah. That was the first point. It was actually, I wanted to respond more to the first part. Yeah.
I just thought arguably the new standards have added a bit more complexity to the calculations.
Yeah. Oh, so that's
getting
where
back to Greg's point about we don't get bogged down in that.
Yeah, and that's where I was going to get to. I mean, actually, it was what you flowed onto then about the board, etc. I'm of the view, and this is the way the current 1995 Act, I think it is written. I don't understand why people have a different view. It is quite clear the board is responsible for the capital management of the organisation. Even under capital adequacy, the actuary is responsible for calling out what the capital adequacy is and the capital adequacy requirements. But it's the company who has to put the money up. It's not the actuary. And the board is responsible and has always been that. To me, LAGIC just reinforces the board is the responsible entity, the responsible group of people who are required here. The actuary, as he always has been, is an advisor. And I don't see any change in that at all. And I said, I just think it reinforces that position. That's why I view this opportunity. And if you are a good advisor in that, then hopefully the board might recognise that you're a good advisor, and then you might get invited to the board in due course, but not whilst you're the appointed actuary. Because they won't let you.
Thank you. Is there any other views, questions? If not, actually... I was going to ask one of Heather and Ian, because they say, as is the case, the standards are far more complex than the current ones. Does that not give the profession a sort of greater opportunity to own the capital management and the demystification of the calculations? I mean, isn't that more of an opportunity than a downside?
It's kind of a loaded question, I guess. I guess as an actuary who I deal with the CEOs, the business almost on a daily basis, and I think getting them to even understand or to really feel passionate about a simple capital calculation and how it affects their business is hard. Something that is more complex will be harder to explain, and will be harder. If every time you sit down with them, you have to explain something again and again, then you have limited opportunities, I think, to influence CEOs, business line managers around capital, and I think this makes it harder.
Bernard Smith. I think what comes with that difficulty is the opportunity, and I think the six dependence questions that the marginalists put forward before is where I think we can actually add value. The calculation is more complex, there are these interactions in there, but understanding what little bubbles and big bubbles might do to those results, I think, is a real opportunity for us as a profession. What can the Institute do about that? That's a little bit harder, because I think some of those discussions are sort of things that are very idiosyncratic. They apply to your company, they may not apply to other companies, but there are some common principles, some tipping points, I think was the phrase that was used, inflections, that I think it's well worth the profession understanding earlier rather than later.
Just to respond to that, I think that, we are going to be able to sort of make the most of this opportunity, but this isn't more of an opportunity than we currently have. At the moment, the business is coming to us and they're asking us these questions, and we're able to give them easy, straightforward answers. Now, the business isn't going to understand that the standards have got this much more complicated. There are all sorts of interdependencies to worry about. We now need to figure out how we're going to allocate capital between the products and socialise that with all of the lines of business, all of the different products, and make sure everyone's happy with that. I think they're not going to understand that these new challenges are necessarily in there and in some way adding value to them, particularly if capital doesn't change for them or goes up slightly. And so I think that, both Ian and I at the moment can, fairly quickly answer a question from the business. And if that becomes harder for us, the business isn't going to sort of respect that. They're going to wonder why on earth, when we could answer a question last week, we're now struggling to answer that question, or we're now putting conditions on our answer.
Thanks. Michael Stumbles from BT Financial Group. I think there's a real question here about resources too. If you start spending a lot more time on more complex calculations, then you've got to spend more of your time and more of your team's time doing that and more time explaining it. If you're doing that, then there is a real danger with these explanations that you're giving if they become more complicated to the business, that the business will start to develop their own rules of thumb and they stop coming to us for that advice and they just apply their own rules of thumb. So conquering this complexity in being able to communicate it is going to be, I think, a real challenge. And I'm kind of a bit concerned, I guess, from the perspective of resourcing as well, in terms of if we don't make it very clear to people that they are complex at the same time, then it's going to push us ourselves more into that corner of being the calculator, because these things are hard and you've got to figure it out and you've got to do it right. And the ability for us to have that headspace, that time to think strategically and really give that strategic advice might start to be impaired. So to really be that partner, I think we not only have to communicate clearly about the dependencies and what the answer is, but also clearly illustrate what the challenges are as well. And these are two things. I think another area which is worth kind of mentioning is the interaction between the FCR and the ICAP. So, you know, we already do a financial condition report, and then in the title of internal capital adequacy assessment process, it again is a type of assessment, and the assessment is being done with responsibility of the board. To what extent is the actuary or the appointed actuary also playing a role in that assessment? And where's the interaction with the FCR? Is this undermining something we're doing in the FCR, or are we going to grasp the opportunity to try and really make it complementary?
Michael, you raise a good point there with the ICAP, and we are expecting further guidance in the near future, but that is possibly an area where we could be proactive to debate more.
I fully agree. I think that's an opportunity for us to develop. I'll say where I'm coming from. ICAP is a process of how you manage and identify risks and accept risks and things like that, and it's all about making sure the board understands what the hell the company's doing. To me, the FCR is all about reporting on, actually, this is what you said you're going to do, are you actually doing it? And what are the outcomes of it? That's how I see the two relate. And clearly, in terms of setting that, if you're like understanding that process, you will want to understand some sort of budgeting or future process scenarios, what could go wrong. And that's how, the actuary will play into that space in providing the numbers. ICAP is Internal Capital Adequacy Assessment Process. From go to woe, what are you as a company doing to accept and understand your risk you're taking? That's the way I read what they're being asked to do. So I don't think there's in conflict with all of the FCR. I think they're complementary.
Greg?
Yeah, I was just going to agree. I see the ICAP report as being a bit like another thing that's like the financial statements. Having financial statements the board has to sign hasn't undermined the role of the CFO. They actually rely big time on the CFO for governance and reassurance that what they've got in front of them is right. I think ICAP will only mean that they look even more to the actuary and the FCR to, as part of their governance and assurance, to know that somebody who actually knows what they're talking about has looked at this thing and said it's okay. So I don't see there's any undermining in that.
Agree with you as well, in such as the ICAP, it's really, as Kevin has said, it's a process. I see it as being much wider than the FCR and a much larger process, and therefore, and more forward looking. Sorry. Just to ask on the phone whether there's any questions. We've dominated a little bit here from Sydney. No questions on the phone?
Rob, I'll just make one comment, if that's all right. Going back a little bit to, on a general theme, but going back to Greg's comments on Moz earlier, I work at a big accounting firm, and the other day one of the partners at that firm, who is an accountant, made the comment that if you want to go and talk to a client about life insurance accounting standards, it's the only industry where you don't bring along an accountant, you bring along an actuary. So whatever happened at the outset of Moz, we've become the experts in life insurance accounting. So, you know, perhaps we didn't get on the front foot well enough at the time. I wasn't around at the time, but I'm sure there's no one sort of better placed than us to become the experts on this, and so maybe it's just a matter of getting on the front foot earlier and noting Michael's challenges with resourcing, etc. That's going to be the challenge, but
Any other views, comments, questions?
My point around that was, though, we got very stuck in the calculations, and we gave sort of answers, I think, when the role play over here was going on. You know, oh, it depends on this, and this, you know. When, in fact, what we need to do is stand back and be one of the users of the results, if you like, and an explainer of the results, and take off our hat that we got stuck almost aligning ourselves with APRA as the one doing the results. You have to sort of try and separate out what you're doing there. And a good example is you know, that exact answer when you're talking about, you know, we're going to get more into equities, what does it mean? My former life, I was quite familiar with a portfolio. It had about three different bits to it. It was a complex, you know, asset liability structure. And the answer would be, because of diversification, if that business unit over there cut back their exposure, the capital on these guys went up because the diversification went down. It was quite an interesting story to go and tell those guys over there, oh, by the way, your capital charge has gone up this week. Why? Oh, because they're doing something, you know. And you actually have to step back and say, well, hang on, that doesn't make sense from a business perspective. Let's think about how we can repackage the way we allocate capital so that when these guys do something, it doesn't change these guys. And the answer was, well, you know, everyone got 20 cents of capital for the first bit and then 40 cents and then it was 50 and the last, whoever's got the biggest one going up and down, yeah, they had a big capital charge and it was marginal. You know, so that's what I mean. Like, you're trying to step back from, don't get bogged down into the nitty-gritty and give technical answers to stuff. Try and think about what it really means from a business sense.
Rob, I'd like to just come back to a couple of the comments that Michael and Kevin have raised about the distinction between the FCR, which is a report, and ICAAP, which is a process, and of course has a report and a summary statement and a whole bunch of other things, so it's a framework. And I think therein lies a glowing opportunity for actuaries, but not necessarily for the appointed actuary. The appointed actuary is the person responsible for the FCR, and as Kevin made the point, that he's really the leading representative of the whole of the actuarial brand in the company. Under LAGIC, the area that I think, as I read it, is most clearly responsible for the embedding of ICAAP, which is an area that is reporting to or supervised, governance by the board, is the risk function. So we may see the rise and rise of the chief risk officer. And therein lies a brilliant opportunity for actuaries to put their stamp of authority as experts in ICAAP.
Yeah, related to that, a good question for Brendan and Kevin. Right. With the new standards and the supervisory adjustments, do you think this is going to bring a closer alignment of sort of capital management and risk management? And do you think that how do you think the profession should to respond to this?
Well, I think it has to, because the two are going to be intertwined through the ICAAP process. Again, if we let ourselves get bogged down in the detail of the capital side and the calculations, then others may step into that risk management side, but they will be the takers of information from us and potentially taking the credit for that. If we step into that role, which I think we're well placed to do, then the capital and the risk management through the ICAAP will all be intertwined, and I think we'll be well placed to deal with that.
I'll come from a different angle and I'll say the risk team or risk management, if you go from step one,
That is, identify what the risks are. How do you mitigate those risks? And then you say, I need capital now to cover those unmitigated risks. And again, I see that's exactly what the actuary does. That's what his role is. So I see this just pulls it all together. It actually says you have to join the nine dots, guys. That's what we've been doing for a long time, but this actually is a formal process, formal way, great opportunity for us to actually say, this is what we actually do. There's no other profession in the company that actually does that.
We'll go to Anthony first, because you haven't asked the question yet.
Anthony Bryant, I suppose I should also make the comment, this is not an official app review. I guess I can make a few comments about some of the things that have been said. I mean, in the current standards, there's talk about there are margins that are allowable to be exercised by the appointed actuary. It's amazing when you look at them how little variation there is and how little explanation of why those margins have been chosen over the past. Maybe there hasn't been that actuarial judgment exercised and explained in the past, which is maybe one of the reasons why there's been a change going forward. I don't know an appointed actuary who doesn't know the ins and outs of their business, so they shouldn't be asking what else you're doing. They should be able to take that into account in doing their calculations and in considering what's going on. And I agree very much with Kevin from the point of view the board has always been responsible. The interaction between the appointed actuary and the board has always been very important, and it's something I think we would see going forward. A challenge we're seeing in the latest mortality investigations that there is mortality deterioration. I challenge an appointed actuary who can explain to me why they're seeing that. So how well do we understand our business? It's the thing about saying, well, what more should you be doing? What more should you be analysing? The step forward of LAGIC is to try and to make capital calculations more risk sensitive. The business is complicated. If management doesn't understand the complications and the interactions of their business, there's a real risk they could go off and make some very bad decisions. So maybe having calculations that make them understand that better makes them more aware of the real implications of what they're doing, rather than saying, oh, this group risk business is really profitable, or this direct marketing business we can make a bucket out of, without actually understanding what the downside risks are. And that's the role of the appointed actuary, to give advice, to understand the risks. So there's a real challenge and opportunity there, I think, is to make sure that the business understands what they're doing, and that's what the appointed actuary is there to try and do.
Thanks. I just wanted to, I guess, make a comment in terms of the ownership, in terms of the actuaries in the ICAAP and the role they play in it and the risk function and what they play. I mean, I'd note that in Europe under Solvency II, the risk function is actually designated under the regulations as the owner of the model, not just the ORSA process, which is the corollary, which I think it's interesting that here that is not the case, that has not been called out. So, I mean, in Europe, I think that resulted in a lot of people just renaming their teams and saying the actuaries were part of the risk function. But I think there is a real opportunity here for us to facilitate that conversation with risk, whether it, you know, being part of finance or being part of risk, however your kind of role is looking, but making sure the different parts of the organisation really are coming together to address the challenges of the ICAAP, and not get, as we were talking about, getting bogged down in the technical detail, but pulling our heads above the water to make sure that we make those conversations happen and work together to do it. So an opportunity, hopefully.
So I might make two more comments. One is the comment earlier about how senior is the appointed actuary within the organisation. I'm aware of quite a number of organisations now where the appointed actuary is not the most senior actuary in the organisation, and what are the complexities that that introduces to the nature of the business. And I guess it's a personal view, but hopefully it's one that's shared within APRA, that I think I would be surprised to think there's an appointed actuary out there who would ever be surprised by a supervisory adjustment. That hopefully there's enough dialogue going on between the appointed actuary and APRA, either through the liaison meetings or one-on-one, so that they know what's going on. Because they're giving advice to the company, it's not always the company following their advice. And if the company doesn't follow their advice, maybe that's one of the reasons why the adjustment's put on.
Yes, that was my point. I'd like everyone to make a few more comments on supervisory adjustments, please.
I mean, one observation, which is if the actuary is slightly provocative and tongue-in-cheek, but if the actuary is doing their job properly, then does that mean that the actuary should be putting some likelihood to supervisory adjustments into the target surplus calculation? If target surplus is about breaching prudential capital requirement, if that's kind of the breach threshold that it's being measured against, then depending on the actuary's view of the extent to which his or her advice is being taken up by the organisation, does that naturally flow through to an element of target surplus, which obviously goes up and down depending on which side of the bed the actuary's got out of.
Could I ask a question throw it out there, that I thought there was a subtle but very significant change of nomenclature within the last 12 months on the part of APRA, because in the response paper in December, as far as I could see, there was little or no reference to target surplus. The references were target capital. And yet, 6 months or a year ago, a lot of the discussion used the term target surplus. So, I mean, is that just what Greg referred to as a change from old-fashioned terminology, from surplus to capital, or is it really a change of emphasis that target capital is something that you build from the ground up, whereas target surplus is something that you maintain on top of your prescribed amount to make sure that you don't run foul of it when things get tough?
The only comment I would make is that the structure around capital and also the APRA's ladder of intervention is all integrated these days. So there's obviously the PCA and then other levels on top of that and that clearance. So, yeah, maybe that is the case. Sorry, Kevin.
I mean, you clearly will have to hold capital above the prescribed capital amount. Otherwise, you run the likelihood of breaching that amount through some sort of adverse event. So call it whatever you want, or target surplus or target capital. There will be, an organisation that manages its own fate, and to keep its licence and be unfettered, will need to hold an amount above the prescribed capital requirement.
I thought as part of the LAGIC, the different rounds that APRA presented on, I thought I'd picked up a strong sense that they were much more strongly of the view that you know, whatever we're going to call this thing, target capital, wasn't a bottom-up calculation. My sense is that's how it's at least been exercised in some quarters of the general insurance industry, much more so than life insurance side. But at least last time I saw stats on this, target surplus was very much thought of in terms of the breach threshold being the prudential capital requirement minimum over some threshold, rather than a bottom-up economic capital type calculation. I thought APRA had made noises through this process that as a structure was the sort of structure they were looking for, simply, well, in part because of the, you know, the ladder of intervention, I think, Rob, as you called it. And so that's certainly where I would understand them to be. I don't know whether there's anyone from APRA that would be game enough to comment on that here.
I'll do the APRA speak. For those of you who don't know me, Kate Bible, I'm in the policy development area. On the terminology, just to do the easy thing first, we have moved away from target surplus, perhaps not as successfully as we'd hoped. So we tend internally to refer to it as target capital, and the point on it being bottom-up versus top-down, I think it's appropriate for the board and senior management to be considering what is the target capital, and obviously APRA's requirements feed into that, but it's not the totality of it, and I think that's a really important point we've tried to communicate, and if we haven't, I'll take that away as a thing to put in the next communication. On supervisory adjustments, I'm aware of the angst in the industry, both life and general insurance, from areas around Pillar 2 adjustments. I guess I would say, and some of that comes from APRA's approach in banking, and we do align with banking where appropriate, but the LAGIC framework is a lot more risk sensitive than our banking framework, and so we're not expecting that a lot of insurers will have Pillar 2 adjustments. They relate more to peculiar risks that aren't captured by the prescribed method, and as the prescribed method is a lot more risk sensitive, we're not expecting those to be large. And also for weaknesses in governance and risk management, or areas around that, the ICAP process, the process. So I would encourage, and we certainly will be communicating this shortly in a more formal sense, but I'll share it with you now. I would encourage any entity, whether it's via their appointed actuary or their normal supervisory contacts with APRA, if you've got a concern about having a Pillar 2 adjustment, you should be approaching your supervisor around that now. And if it's formal communication or a conversation or whatever, I'd encourage you to do that. There's nothing stopping us from having discussions now on that that process. We have provided what I think is a fair amount of guidance in the papers to date around the Pillar 2 adjustment process, so happy to take questions on that. The final thing I would add is just around ICAP guidance, which is, yes, we're releasing a PPG in September, and I would like to encourage you not to wait for that document like it's something that's some sort of miracle from beyond. We've provided a lot of guidance to date to industry around ICAP. We'll be providing a little bit more in the next round of communication with the life and general insurance industry, but there is enough information out there now to be working on that. And we have seen insurers who are already engaging with their boards and senior management around this issue. So I would encourage you, if you haven't started thinking about ICAP and the actuary's role in ICAP, that now's a good time to do that, and I would not wait for this guidance that's coming out in September. It's not some miracle pill.
Tony Boffinger. I guess just in response to that comment, I'd suggest maybe you turn it around as far as who approaches whom. I think in reality the chances of an insurer coming to APRA saying, hey, I think I might need a supervisory adjustment, could you please confirm or deny, they're pretty remote. So maybe if APRA thinks that there should be supervisory adjustments, it's time for them to start talking about it. And I wasn't really going to get into this, but as long as I've got the microphone, I just wanted to make a comment on the complexity stuff and the it depends. Partly, I've always said that most actuarial answers start with it depends, because it is very unlikely that the person who asks the question knows the full ramifications and the full things that can impact it. And I think, to Anthony's point about you should know enough about the business, I think when you're communicating an answer, you also need to communicate what is happening today, but if you think, if it changes, bear in mind my answer will change, and you need to give a bit of an indication of that. I think the rules of thumb and the complexity, I don't know that it is more complex. I think it's just not as familiar. And back when the current standards really first started developing, there was a lot of stuff that went on with people trying to get their heads around what it meant, what the rules of thumb were, what the interactions were. And it's just those things have changed now. And I think we're just going to learn it. Yes, there may be another correlation matrix or something in there, but overall, I actually don't think it's that materially different as far as complexity goes. It's just something new, and you've got to play around with it a little while to find out how it all works.
Okay, I think we appear to be wrapping up. I'll just give those on the phone one more chance to raise any questions. Anybody on the phone? No. I'm hearing from this debate that we are, as a whole, seeing this as an opportunity for actuaries. There's the links to risk management has been mentioned, the opportunity for advice, continuing that connection with the business. I also heard things about being more proactive in the interaction with APRA, both from APRA and from people in the responses about if we've got ideas to share them still. There is still an area, a period where we interpret and apply the rules, and as we work through that, if there's anything that you as the membership have concerns, we can always coordinate it through the task forces or the profession. I also heard an important one about not going down into the technical. You know, stay on the principles, stay on the implications. We run the risk of marginalising ourselves just in the way we actually respond to this and take things forwards. So I thank you all for your input, and I ask you to thank the presenters in the normal way. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah, I think they're going. They were there. I've got a hot stick there, it's a light. Yeah.